I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Okay.
And try, Michael.
Yeah.
Pretty good. I like
getting
it.
Better.
Dear listeners, you are listening to another episode of Everyone is Hot, the podcast where we normally talk about your favorite stealth symbol and the film that turns you on to them. I'm Shelley Brooks.
And I'm Michael Stevens, and I'm really excited about today's topic.
I am as well. You may be wondering why we opened up with some half-hearted whistling.
Or wholehearted whistling.
Wholehearted, half-successful, I guess is what I should have said.
Wholehearted, half-successful. Yes.
Yes, and that is because today we are doing another mini-sode. And this time, it is about the two film adaptations of a personal favorite of ours, West Side Story.
Ta-da-da! Yeah.
Now, listeners, you may be aware that if you're familiar with the musical West Side Story, you might be aware that there are two film adaptations. The first from 1961 that was directed by Robert Wise and co-directed by the original choreographer from the show, Jerome Robbins, director choreographer of the stage show. And then there was another that was done in 2021. This one was directed by Steven Spielberg with a very updated, not very updated, but
pretty updated.
Yeah. Not, I didn't want it to sound like updated as though it was like set in the present day. It still, it keeps all the bones of the original show, but with some very interesting changes in a screenplay by Tony Kushner. So yeah, Michael, we both have a bit of a history with West Side Story. We've talked, I think, before on the podcast about how the 1961 version is your mom's favorite film, correct?
Yes. Gina Maria Stevens, she fucking loves this movie. It's her favorite one. It's a movie I've watched a dozen times every time it's on. So I have like a boomer style relationship with this movie.
Yes.
What about you?
Oh gosh, yeah, I have a long time relationship with the stage show, with the movie. I, you know, started listening to the original cast recording, which, you know, if anyone is not aware, the music in that is by Leonard Bernstein and the lyrics are by Stephen Sondheim. So, you know, a great team making the beautiful music for this show. But yeah, I started listening to it at a very young age. I played Maria in high school, which I know is problematic.
Huh.
But But I was the only one training in opera at the time at my high school. So,
you know what? Yeah. You're forgiven. I was once in a production of The Mikado. So you're,
oh God.
Yeah. You're
listen,
fine.
We've all done non-professional theater where there was some questionable casting. But yeah, and I watched the 1961 film a lot growing up and was always a great fan of it. And then the 2021 version was one of the first movies I saw back in theaters, which was huge. And so yeah. That might be part of my very emotional connection to that version of it as well.
Oh, that's right. This one came out during one of the hell years, one of the many hell years that we're enduring. Where the cinematic landscape is mostly like CGI fuckfest. And it was mostly CGI fuckfest.
Inside with COVID for a long time. So I mean, movie theaters are kind of just reopening. The 2021 film, I think, got pushed for quite a long time before it was released. I think it had been filmed like, you know, several years before it actually was able to come out because of COVID restrictions. So theaters were kind of just reopening when it finally released. Yeah.
And come to think of it, now I'm thinking back more to my relationship with West Side Story. I've seen like a bunch of live versions of it. Most recently, I saw the 2020 revival, which was pretty controversial.
So it was the whole one?
Yeah,
which my friend of mine actually worked on. And I think they ended up closing relatively early because of COVID as well.
I remember being very tentative about getting my tickets. There were also protests and stuff because of, you know, things. There was a lot of stuff going on with that production, but it was, you know, it was fine. So, but I was really excited about the remake until I saw who they cast as Tony, one of my many enemies.
Out of the way.
The reason we're talking about this is because Shelley posted some out of pocket shit about how the remake is better than the original. And me being a boomer, I'm like, absolutely not. Disrespectful. Make America great again. You can't do any better than the 1961 version. And so I watched the most recent version today, this morning. And here I am, hat in hand, humbly declaring just how incorrect I was. Cat's out of the bag. I agree with you, Shelley. I think the new one is much better. Like there are pros and cons to both. Sure. But I'm curious to know what your, I guess, pros and cons would be for both.
Yeah, so I think that, first of all, it's fair to say that we both still love the 1961 version.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, so I think that definitely the pros to that version is that you do get a sort of more accurate picture, I guess, of, you know, what the stage show was like. Because you have the direct involvement of the team. You know, you've got Bernstein, you've got Sondheim, you've got Jerome Robbins, who, you know, was, you know, apparently, I think a lot of both the great things about the movie and also some of the cons about the movie are, I think, probably largely attributable to Jerome Robbins. Because he was, you know, famously a bit of a dictatorial sort of like egomaniac.
Nice.
But we do get to see his like original choreography in that movie, which I think is a huge plus. You know, I think that, you know, Arthur Lorenz was obviously involved. He wrote the book for the stage show and was, you know, involved with, you know, the making of the film. He's another one that I have, you know, both a huge respect for, but also, you know, complicated feelings about, because I think he had complicated feelings towards his own work, especially as he got older. But he also tended, you know, he was a man with an ego, and he, you know, I think wanted to control a lot of things. And I think that there was something very freeing in the 2021 version that, you know, Sondheim was the only one from the team who was still around, And Sondheim was not. And Sondheim was not a great fan of the original film, because he talks a lot in his series, his pair of books, Finishing the Hat, where he talks about like his craft in writing, that he doesn't think that film adaptations of stage musicals are generally very good, because they because they were written for the stage and they were not written to be films. And he felt they were like too precious, that they were, you know, too afraid of straying too far from the source material, and that they just weren't structured in the way that you would naturally structure a movie musical.
Yeah.
And I think that the fact that he was the only one from the original team still around for the making of this second film, and you had people like Spielberg, and even though, you know, Kushner is, you know, most famous for his stage work, he also is an incredibly accomplished screenwriter. So you've got two people who just like fundamentally understand the medium of film and aren't tied to the stage, that like they were able, I think they were really liberated to make some changes that are, you know, maybe feel sacrilegious to someone who is like really wedded to the stage version, but I think work incredibly well for a film. And for me, like artistically felt very liberating. Cause I mean, I, you know, I've frequently kind of toyed around with like, you know, writing a little screenplay adaptation of a musical that I like, but I've always been afraid about like, you know, would it be disrespectful to change things too drastically? And there is no sense of that in the 2021 film.
Yeah.
Like, they change things drastically.
You have to. You absolutely have to. You're dealing with a different audience that has different expectations based on the medium that they're paying to go see. So like, I think this is apparent in all kinds of adaptations, books to movies, comic books to movies, plays to movies, and especially musicals to movies. This is a tangent, but you know that they split Wicked into two different movies. It's going to be
so
like
fucking stupid. So stupid.
It's fucking like as if one was not enough. We got two of these motherfuckers coming out.
And I can't say this is anything other than like a cash grab. Like there's no way this could have been artistically motivated unless they are padding it so much. And that's the another thing that I think is interesting sometimes in the adaptations from a stage musical to a movie musical, that like you don't get in musicals that are written like directly for the screen, is that, I mean, time just functions differently. Like you have to like communicate information differently. The pacing of scenes is different. So, you know, I mean, listen, there are plenty of movie musical like adaptations that make choices that I think were intended to make it work better on screen that I don't think work. Like, for example, I thought the recent movie of Into the Woods was bad. Even though Sondheim was directly involved, I thought it was a bad movie. I thought they made some ill-advised cuts to it. But I mean, I think also part of the problem is that you just don't have a director of like Spielberg's ability on a movie like that, you know? And I'm not saying that like, you know, Sondheim's ideas about movie musicals are, you know, infallible. I mean, obviously he's a genius, but I mean, for example, he, until West Side Story, his like favorite adaptation of his work was Tim Burton's Sweeney Todd, which I thought was awful. So like,
really?
I hated it. Yeah.
Well, not that you hated it. I expected you to hate it. The fact that Stephen Sondheim.
To be fair, there weren't many adaptations of his work. I mean, I guess that, I mean, you've got like Gypsy, but again, he just wrote the lyrics for that one. He didn't write the music. But I mean, it's slim pickings when it comes to like his musicals. Because I mean, what, you've got like the A Little Night Music from the 70s with Elizabeth Taylor, which is a complete disaster. And I mean, yeah, so it's like not like he had much to choose from, but I do think that he appreciated that there were changes made to make it feel like a movie and
they
not just like a filmed stage version.
They took out they took out that part.
They took out the Judge's Joanna. Like, I mean, like, they're were a lot of questionable choices, I thought.
And
also,
I just
don't like the Tim Burton aesthetic.
I appreciate Tim Burton for what he is and what he do, but like, that particular choice, because that's my favorite shit. Like,
I know.
But his reasoning for taking it out was like, I don't want, like, you're already attending the tale of Sweeney Todd. Like, so it's like, so I'm sorry, my my guy, do you not get musicals? Like,
yeah.
We sing about what's happening. We sing about what's going to happen. We sing about what happened already. God.
Yeah, no, not great. And I think that, like, yeah, that there is, I think, something that's great about the 2021 version of West Side Story is that, like, even though they take a lot of liberties, they are ultimately, like, very reverent towards the music. I mean, like,
yeah.
It's so beautifully sung, and I think that it's interesting, like, looking back on, like, the 61 version, where, you know, you have someone like, you know, a Natalie Wood playing Maria, which, I mean, you know, obviously there's, like, the, you know, ethnicity issues around that, but I mean, also just the fact that, like, you know, she's not a singer. I mean, she was being dubbed by Marnie Nixon. I mean, she's a lovely, you know, lovely actor, but I mean, they really made a point of getting people who are true, like, triple threats for the characters in the 2021 version. And it meant, Ansel, I know we can have problems with him. I do.
He's a good dancer. He was good. He was good.
Yeah. I think he's genuinely pretty good in the movie. Like, whatever his, like, personal life issues are.
I do not like Ansel. I have beef with him.
I think he sucks. I think he sucks so much, but I think he's
good.
He's not bad in the movie. Yeah.
He's and then you have not like bad.
Really. Then you have really wonderful people like Ariana DeBose and like Mike Faist, who are, I mean, just incredible. And like the supporting cast has pulled so much from Broadway with, like, you know, Brian D'Arcy James playing Officer Krupke. I think it's beautiful that they brought back Rita Moreno, that they changed the character of Doc so that she could play the role in a way that I found really beautiful. I thought that was maybe the most interesting difference that they had in the film, was the way that they transformed the character of Doc.
I also think, like, I don't know, it's interesting that Steven Spielberg was probably a kid around the time that he was a kid when this movie came out. And so, I don't know. I think it's much easier to be a bit more objective about what was actually happening in that time regarding, sociology and race relations. I don't know. I don't know that there was actually, like, any, you know, beef between, I guess they're Polish. I just see white people.
Yeah, I think they're supposed to be a bit kind of like multiracial, like, working class white people. Like, I think Tony's supposed to be Polish, but I think that it's kind of like everyone who had, you know, maybe not previously been in the fold of whiteness, who had been folded in recent years as there was no immigration of, like, Latinx people, you know, that it's like, okay, now we got to make you guys white so that we can other these other people.
I did get the sense that, like, whiteness in this iteration of West Side Story was like a subscription, like a loose knit group of, like, okay, you're part of the club now, but you got to play by these rules.
Yeah.
Versus,
and then they know it's kind of conditional, like.
Yeah, it's, you know, much different from, like, all right, they're Puerto Rican, fuck them, you know.
Right.
And I guess, like, in many different in modern interpretations of West Side Story, you do see that. Like, I know in the revival, Jets were the Sharks and the Jets were a much more mixed group, which I think to some points it does make sense. To other points, it's like, this is too distracting that there are now black people with the white people, and they've got beef with the black people, with the Latinx black people. It was too much for me to think about, and I just, you know, I think you can do that, but maybe get a director who understands what race relations are actually.
I didn't see that production, but I do think that Eva Von Hova, like, doesn't understand America, and he especially doesn't understand New York, because I saw his production of Angels in America and I was like, this man has spent a lot of time in New York, but it feels like he has never even seen a movie about New York based
on the
way he, like, treated this play. But I think even from the beginning, it was, I think that there was a very much a sense of like the conditionality of whiteness, like in, because I mean, you know, originally the musical was supposed to be about like an Irish gang and a Jewish gang.
Yes.
Yeah. And it wasn't until like later in the process that they changed it, because they're like, this is what the youths are really like.
Yeah.
And I think, and all of the creators on it, I mean, they all had that experience of that sort of conditional whiteness, because they were all, you know, white Jewish men.
Right.
So, I mean, they had had the experience of like their, you know, parents' generation not having that same sort of access to whiteness that like they then had in their generation. So, yeah, I think that that's something, because especially like in light of like seeing the Fabelmans, like his like Spielberg's experience with like anti-Semitism in that movie, like,
right.
I think, yeah, definitely he probably had like a real insight into like what this actually felt like in the period.
Yeah.
For like a young person.
And so that's why I think it's great and good that we got Steven Spielberg, someone who's actually had like got an experience of that time, doing an updated version of this, because he's, you know, thinking about things he's actually experienced versus, you know, mm-hmm. some young guy who's not really experienced the time period that he's, you know, that he's adapting. David Lynch talks, I'm not going to talk too much about him, but he does, in his biography, he talks about, you know, how like biopics from the from now kind of are shit because, you know, a lot of people don't really know, a lot of the directors don't really know how to capture the feeling of the time that they're trying to actually capture. So I really appreciated that in this version, that like you get a sense of like, it felt like photographs you know, of the time. And I feel like it's much easier. Sometimes it can be much easier to look back on the past and create it, if you've actually experienced, versus looking at the present time and trying to capture it. Like, you're not going to be quite as objective, because you don't know what comes after that. So I don't know. This is 1961 adapting 1950 whatever, versus 2021, greater understanding of, you know, what's actually going on.
Well, I mean, you know, speaking of that, I mean, it's like, you know, Spielberg and Kushner, I mean, have both experienced New York over the decades.
Yes.
And I think it's very interesting that, I mean, this film had, I think maybe its premiere was at Lincoln Center. And a big part of the film that Kushner added to it was the destruction of housing on the Upper West Side for the creation of Lincoln Center.
Yep.
That is like in the movie. So the people watching this in beautiful Lincoln Center were being, you know, sort of like directly implicated in ways, which, I mean, of course then raises the question of like, how much are you really implicating if you're still having your premiere at Lincoln Center, but like on your big budget movie. But
I just
but it is
got
interesting that like you had to consider it.
I just got like chills and tingles with you saying that, which means you like you're saying something very important that I want to fucking underline for anyone that listens to this podcast and loves watching movies. Like, this is like I do feel like the past is being erased, and like like real fucking history, like the important things that should get you fucking charged up and angry are just kind of getting dropped from you know, the way that we remember the past, the way that we teach the past to the next generation. So I do love, you know, when our fucking boys are like, nope, this is the way it really went down. And this is the way it's also kind of going down now, like gentrification. It happened then, and it's fucking happening now. And if you're watching this movie and going like, oh, that's kind of like what's happening now, like, yes.
Right.
Yes. Because history repeats itself all the fucking time. And it's kind of like, I think for like a lot of artists of many disciplines, like, it's, you get to a point in your career where it's like your responsibility to use your power to help people remember, especially with movies and cinema. Like, that's what I think the social good that they produce is helping us not to forget, even when all of our systems want us to. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think that the movie does a really good job of, because I mean, it's so easy because West Side Story is so, so well known. And it's like, you hear like, I feel pretty, like in commercials and shit. It's like, it's easy to sort of make a separation between like what's actually happening in the story and the sort of like cultural associations we all have with it. It's like, everyone's heard the songs like America. They've heard the songs Tonight, like whatever. And I think that this movie does a really good job of not treating it like a museum piece, not treating it like a piece of like cultural kitsch or something, but making it feel immediate. And like in so many small ways, I mean, there's the Lincoln Center stuff. There's also the fact that, so like in the stage show and in the 61 film, you know, I Feel Pretty happens within like the dress shop while they're working there, a small group of friends. And I think it's such a beautiful little touch that they reset it into a department store where Maria is like on the like nighttime cleaning crew. And so you see them surrounded by all of this like expensive, all these expensive, beautiful goods. But you see the reality of her life is that, you know, she is this young woman who works really hard at night cleaning for other people. And like it, you don't get to like separate the reality of like what their lived experience would be with like, oh, I know that tune, you know?
Yeah. God, I absolutely loved that scene. And that was probably the moment where I was like, ugh, I'm wrong. Like, this is so much better, because that's when I started to look at the 1961 version of like, as like, there's no real attempt to like actually engaged with the lived experiences of people of color in that time. And we know this because there's white people playing Puerto Ricans. There's, you know, Greeks playing the Puerto Ricans. There's like not, but in this one, you know, I loved that.
Oh, sorry. Well, it's just, it is funny that even at the time they felt like they were making changes from the stage show that made it more politically aware, like changing the lyrics to America, that America before, like on this, in the stage show, America feels kind of gross because it's like an argument between Anita and this like other girl, and the girl's like, I love Puerto Rico, and Anita's like, it sucks that everything's bad there, like it's gross and you'll be poor. And then in the movie they change it to like the women saying like, you know, I'm excited for the opportunities in America, and the men saying like, yeah, but only, you only really get access to those if you're white, and like, you know, it's hard here and we want to go back home because we've been otherized and brutalized here. So they were making an attempt at the time.
Progress.
It didn't go as far as it needed to. I was just like, around this sort of like going back to the idea about not being as precious about the source material, is that one thing that I really like on a sort of aesthetic level is that, you know, because of Jerome Robbins's involvement in it, I mean, he's been very strict about, like, you know, in productions of the show, like requiring the original choreography, and a lot of the way that it's shot in the 1961 version is made to showcase that choreography.
In service, yeah.
Yeah. And I love that, like, that's so not the case in the 2021 version. Cause, like, for example, in the song Cool, it's so kinetic, and it like it's not worried about the dancing so much as just like physically depicting the struggle between it. Like, again, they like redo it because like it's not Tony who sings Cool in the stage show or in the earlier movie, but they make it, you know, a thing between Tony and Rift, and like showing them like physically like having this sort of battle over like whether to be violent or not.
I did love that scene, and another moment where I was like, fuck, they really cast the right, like, Ansel, he can move. He can move.
Yeah.
I'll give him that. I did really like that scene, and I, you know, I'm, as just like a regular person with no training, no home training, watching this,
I've seen you dancing, Cats.
I see, but the many moons ago, another life, I loved how it's like, oh, this isn't quite as pristine as the original. You know, they're not in perfect straight lines. It's very asymmetrical. I can also see the performers, like, you know, exert effort. It doesn't look quite as, you know, easy peasy as the original. And these are things that I do like, even in choreography and in like even fucking fight choreography, when something looks, you know, looks the way it should feel, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it feels more exciting when it seems like there's maybe an element of danger almost to it. Or yes. That something could go wrong, that you're like, oh, that it keeps you engaged.
So I have a question. What were other moments of the film? If you were to pick like three moments of the film that made you go like, oh God, like so much better. Or moments between that moments from the modern version that kind of hit a lot harder is probably the easiest way I can ask that.
Yeah. Oh God, there are so many, but I feel like, I mean, it makes the rounds on Twitter a lot, and for good reason, because, so, you know, Spielberg famously doesn't like storyboard his scenes. Like, I mean, he famously just kind of like almost like decides like when he's on set. And obviously this is a thing that you can do if you are able to command a budget like Spielberg, because like you've got all the resources available that you need.
That's
on
wild.
Set. Like, and it's crazy. I mean, the thing is, yeah, he's a genius. Like, but so it makes the rounds a lot on Twitter, this scene when they're going into the dance at the gym, and it has that tracking shot going through the hallway with like Anita and Maria and all.
Oh yeah, friends. That shit is, yeah.
And then it goes into this like insane crane shot, and then it like comes back down and it like snakes through the dancers. I think I've seen that there's like a behind the scenes thing that shows how they mapped out that shot, but watching it, I literally cannot figure out how they did it. Like, because usually when you're watching a film, you could go like, okay, I can see it. Like, they probably had some like dolly tracks here, and then they like probably like maybe there was some sort of like they craned up here or whatever. I don't know how they did it. I don't know how they choreographed the movement between the camera and the dancers. Like, it makes no sense.
That's so hard. Like, that sounds so
remarkable.
that must have been a really fun day.
And a nightmare. Exhausting day, and like difficult day, like, especially because you have so many young actors who hadn't.
How many times do they have to fucking do that? Like,
yeah, as they're doing this like intense dancing, and it's like, I mean, I think about like Rachel Zegler, who plays Maria, who was like 18, had never done a movie, and like just imagine coming onto like a Spielberg set with this like complicated camera choreography, and it's like, all right, you're the lead. Off to the races. Like, and so I think it really can't be overstated, like the incredible visual skill of Spielberg, but also just like the beautiful cinematography by Janusz Kaminski. This movie is just absolutely gorgeous to look at, and I love that, like, in the recent years as he's like worked with Kaminski, he's like had this interesting element in some of his films of these kind of like light flares that happen a lot that I find so beautiful. There's the scene in the apartment where Anita is like behind a sort of like sheer piece of fabric and like kisses Bernardo through it.
That is God.
And really, and that, like, I like that Bernardo gets really humanized in this movie in a way that like he just is sort of underwritten in the stage show and in the 61 movie, and he feels so much more fleshed out in this one.
Yeah.
And it's not even that they changed the writing of him that much, but it's genuinely just because it's shot so beautifully, and the way that the camera treats him so lovingly is
he's like a real human being versus an angry guy.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I love George Chakiris, who plays him in the 61 version, but but he really is kind of required to play him kind of just one note angry guy, you know?
Yeah. Oof. Yeah. Now what about you? Oof. God. I think the ending where Maria gets the gun and she's about to she had pulled the trigger on her boy, and I was like, oh God, she's really mad. They made a big change. Big fucking change. But I rewound, and that's not what happened. It's just, I could hear it's a very pretty like silent scene. Like, you, I don't know. I really appreciated the sound design, I guess.
Yeah.
And like, I could hear the gun and how heavy it was.
Yeah.
And, you know, I it drove the sense of how awful the moment was. God, yeah. I loved that scene a lot. And then I guess moments that made me go like, oh, this is better than the original. The scene where, oh God, Anita is, so her man's just been killed and she goes into Doc's to confront the Jets on Maria's behalf. And she's looking to speak with Tony. And I got the sense of like, I felt real genuine danger, like fear for Anita in a way that I had not felt in previous versions. I feel like there's a tendency to underplay that scene as like, oh, these boys are just being super disrespectful. And then I've seen
a lot of like pushing her from person to person, her being like, oh.
Yeah, they like ruffle with her dress and stuff where it's like the way the Montagues, you know, fuck with the nurse, you know. But and then I've seen other versions where they kind of overcorrect and it's like. More it's more than you want. But like. I got the feeling of like genuine fear and the women be kind of, you know, fearing for her and they're, you know, like. That scene that really like got me in my chest in a way that like I, you know, had not been gotten. I thought it was very well acted and
I think on a similar note, I mean, I love Russ Tamblyn in the 61 film as Riff. I think he's, you know, he's wonderful in it, but there are a few things that they add for Riff, played by Mike Faced in the 21 version, that give him so this intensity of anger and feelings of like nihilism and hopelessness that like you know from the beginning, like this kid is fucked. Like this kid's not making it out alive. And I think that that makes his relationship with Tony so moving and so painful. And that he also feels like he's not just some like goofy guy who kind of gets in over his head, but you're like, this is a kid who's got no fucking opportunities. And now he's determined to like burn the world down around him and he's going to get himself killed.
Ooh, I'd say the third element of all things is I absolutely agree with that. And now it's making me think like, oh, I kind of like, I did like connected to the Jets in a way that I hadn't before because most of the time when I watch a movie that's about, you know, that has racism, I'm usually like, I'm on the side of the people of color. That's just my natural response. And I don't think it should be because conflicts are not necessarily wrong. But I think, you know, there is in a good movie, you should be able to empathize with the protagonists and the antagonists. And, you know, a really great movie shouldn't have any agonists. They're just, you know, people living in a world and it's making them do things, you know, like The Wire or some shit. But I really got the sense of like, ah, fuck, like this is the only way for these boys to be. They are, they're fucked. And that made Officer Krupke like hit so much harder for me, that number, just because it's like, oh yeah, they're trapped. They're fucking trapped.
And that it's, that, you know, it's that they're wrong to be, to, you know, treat the Puerto Rican people in the movie the way that they treat them. But also that that is a purposeful thing of like that people in power, they don't give a shit about any of these people. So then it's much more convenient for them to fight amongst themselves than it is for them to realize like that they actually have much more of their interests aligned.
The whole movie, I was like, what if they do something crazy? What if they do something crazy? Like, I can't say what I'm about to say because I feel like we might get... I was like, there are people that could be killed in this movie if these two groups just collaborate and I could drive myself insane.
I think this movie really does a great job of underlining like how little the difference in what their needs and their interests are, and how easily they could be aligned, and like this how dumb it is that they have these like cultural divisions instead of recognizing that like they're both getting fucked by like their buildings getting torn down.
I should say that while I had been watching West Side Story this morning, I had also been doom scrolling and watching lots of Stokely Carmichael videos. So I've been thinking about nonviolence and like the utter pointlessness of it in a world that doesn't believe in the rights of a whole ass class of people. But that did kind of color how I was watching this movie. I was just like, yo, Officer Krupke just needs to get fucking crupped. We need to crupt the shit out of this motherfucker.
Right.
But God, if I open that can of worms, I feel like we're going to talk about West Side Story again. We should.
I think we have to, because we are definitely running out of time, but there's so much to say about this movie. We barely got to touch on the individual actors, and I mean, the cast is incredible across the board, and they are all so hot.
So we will talk about this again, hopefully one day. We have not a lot of time, but Shelley, I did have one quick rapid fire question for you before we wrap up. So similar to how Steven Spielberg directed a beloved, untouchable classic that most people would say, you can't remake that. What director and classic film would you pair together for a modern remake?
Oh.
Yeah, it's a fucked up question.
It is. Fuck you, Michael.
It's a so fucked fun. Up question.
Wait, okay. Do you have one in mind so I can think for a second? Well, that's so hard.
So I do not have one. I have an example, and then I can think a little bit more about mine. But I talked about it. I mentioned the Lynch Oz documentary, and that documentary centers on David Lynch's relationship with a movie like with The Wizard of Oz. And so I, you know, the whole time watching that, I'm like, well, the easiest thing that I would want to see is a David Lynch Wizard of Oz. I love The Wizard of Oz. And I would love to see what a modern day interpretation would look like. I mean, especially with what we know about, you know, the social situation at the time, you know, climate change. There's a thing that I feel like we can fold in. Our relationship with false worlds, fantasy worlds that are created, and, you know, social media. Like, I feel like there's a lot that an old director's experience of the modern world would have to create a new a version of that. So
that's interesting.
But my pick would actually be, that's the obvious one. My pick that I'd want to see is, I'd want to see David Lynch do an update on It's a Wonderful Life. That's what I'd want to see.
Oh, I love that idea so much. Oh, that's really good.
Yeah. I want to see David Lynch explore, like, what is the world of a guardian angel look like? Like, why is Clarence doing all this shit? Like, let's get more into Clarence and why he's doing what he's doing, and like, what is this darkness? What is really the darkness that George Bailey is dealing with?
Yeah.
You know, like, I want to see it.
I love that so much. Oh my God. That's great.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to say, okay. I'm going to say All About Eve, directed by Catherine Breillat.
Whoa. Who is that? Yeah. And
so, Breillat, she's a French director, and she did like the movie Fat Girl. She did like The Last Mistress, but one that I really, really loved, I think she's got another film out maybe this year, But like the last film of hers that I saw was back in 2013. Yeah, she does have one this year. It's called Last Summer. But her last movie that I saw was 10 years ago. It's called Abuse of Weakness. And it's, I fucking love this film because it's a kind of autobiographical movie that she did after she had a stroke. And she ended up having this like affair with this like, you know, very sort of strapping younger man that turned into this kind of like financial abuse, basically. And so it's the story of this like older woman who's been kind of like incapacitated, who ends up like, you know, giving all of her money away to this young guy. I think she could do something really, really interesting and dark, but she's also very funny.
Yeah.
But absolutely brutal. And I think she could do something really interesting in All About Eve with that relationship of like an older actress and a younger one who wants to like usurp her. Like, I think it would be incredibly different from the original, but also retain some of like the kind of like acidic spirit of it in a way that would be really interesting.
Ooh, okay. This is a conversation that we have to revisit in a future mini because.
Oh, hell yeah.
I feel like there are a lot of modern working directors that would have very interesting takes on older films. And I do love what a remake can do to fully kind of. What am I trying to say? I like what a remake can do to enhance the experience of watching the original. Mm-hmm. I think that what's fun about these West Side Stories is that neither one cancels out the other, and each enhances the other because, you know, we can take ourselves out of the movie and recognize, oh, like the worlds that are creating both of these pieces of art, they're very different. Mm-hmm. That's the fun is in figuring out like what has changed. That's why I love movies.
I know. Yeah. So we definitely need to do an episode about that. And I would love to do an episode about which modern directors we think should adapt which musicals.
Ooh. Okay. Let me close.
That is an episode for another day. Another day. Listeners. Well, thank you so much for tuning in again to Everyone is Hot. And Michael, what should the listeners do?
Stay horny. Stay horny. Stay horny. Please stay horny.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.